There was a demonstration that took place on the following Saturday, which was the 21st of June, of the returned veterans who were fully in support of the strike, and they were marching down Winnipeg, down Main Street, Winnipeg, and to protest the arrest of the leaders, and also to send a delegation to Senator Gideon Robertson, who at that point was ensconced in the Royal Alexander Hotel in Winnipeg. The demonstration was fired on by the RCMP. The demonstration was broken up. One man was killed, 30 were wounded. Both numbers were arrested. The next day or the day after that, the strike paper was banned. The bulletin that the strikers had issued during the strike was banned. And the man that was the acting editor was arrested, Fred Dixon. And then Woodsworth, J.S. Woodsworth, took over from him, and he was arrested. And therefore, on June the 25th, the strike committee met and decided that the government was not going to allow the settlement of this strike. They were prepared even to kill rather than to settle. They were prepared to arrest people, as they had already done. So the strike committee called off the strike on June the 25th, effective June the 25th.
And all the people that had gone on strike initially were still out on by the 25th?
Yeah, no, nobody had gone back.
The city must have experienced some pretty strange things. No one working.
Yes. They maintained certain minimum services. And these services that were maintained had a card on them, authorized by the strike committee, like the delivery of milk, the maintenance of water power at a certain level of pressure, and some other things like that. But otherwise, the whole city was at a standstill. There were no street cars. There were no telephones. The telephone bills had gone out in strike. The papers had gone out in strike, too. But then the newspaper publishers raised a big cry that this was done as to choke off freedom of speech. So the strike committee allowed the newspapers to be published, which was a big mistake because the newspapers really fed the whole press of Canada with the false stories of what was going on in Winnipeg. And they declared the story that was put out by the Citizens Committee and the government and the newspapers of Winnipeg was that this was a Bolshevik plot to overthrow the government and to set up a Soviet form of government such as had been set up in November 1917 in Russia. And a lot of people bought it. But the people of Winnipeg didn't buy it. They, as I just mentioned, remained steadfast out on strike. But this was actually the charge under which the men were tried. They were tried for seditious conspiracy. And one of the points of the seditious conspiracy was that they had conspired to overthrow the lawful government of Canada and establish a Soviet form of government. Of course, the strike committee, which was an extension of the Trades and Labor Council, was made up of liberals, conservatives, socialists, and people without any political affiliations. It was a great struggle for collective bargaining, the rights of collective bargaining, which are generally recognized today.
How many actual communists were there in Winnipeg at that time?
Well, the Communist Party was not formed until 1921. 2 years after the strike. There were two socialist parties, who called themselves Marxist parties. There was the Socialist Party of Canada, which Mr. Pritchard, Mr. Johns, and Russell belonged to.
Armstrong.
There was the Social Democratic Party, to which Queen and Heath belonged. There was the Dominion Labor Party, which was a party, it wasn't a socialist party at all, it was a single tax party headed by Fred Dixon. And there was the ILP, the Independent Labor Party. And then there was, of course, the liberals and conservatives who had trade unionists in their party. So the strike was a strike for the aims that it had set itself. Of course, that's now clear. Everybody accepts that today, but they didn't accept it then. And that's why these men went to prison, because, as I say, the government sold the public on this idea.
I know that during the trials, they used Marxist literature, and I think the Communist Manifesto and other pamphlets written by Marxists as evidence in the trial. Were they, were they rare documents, or were they fairly widespread? Were they easily attainable?
The North American publisher of Marxist literature, Marxist and Engels work, was Charles H. Kerr in Chicago. And they put out quite a volume of literature, which was freely available in bookstores and right across North America. These books were not something that were hidden or furtively brought into the country. They were, as I say, published by this well-known publishing company. But what had happened is that a year before the strike, the government, during the war, the government under order and council had set up what they called the chief censor. And he had power to ban all literature coming from, that he did, thought would be harmful, all literature coming from outside the country. And he banned all this Marxist literature. So effectively, it was illegal to have a copy of the Communist Manifesto in your pocket. And secondly, that as Mr. Pritchard pointed out in his address to the jury, in a sense, they put the Communist Manifesto on trial. See? They wanted to prove that this was the blueprint for overthrowing the government, and this was what the strikers were adhering to.
They put Tim Noel's Fragments of Science on trial. They put Gilbert and Sullivan's Plays on trial. They put The Origin of Species by Darwin on trial. And they did it because this man was stupid. I met him. Colonel Chambers. He was totally ignorant. Whether he drafted the order in council, I don't know, but somebody who drafted it had no knowledge of the English language to make it clear in the very language of the thing. That's the point I brought up in the trial. Does this mean a postcard and one other piece of literature of Charles H. Kerr and Cummings in the language, or two others, or three others, or how many? But what it says is a postcard and other. Big difference. And other publications have said Charles H. Kerr. Now what other? So we can never find out what he had banned. Huh? I've got a list, big list of them. It's in the speech somewhere. That is, a few of them that were banned under that thing. Oh, Herbert Spencer's Social, you heard of Herbert Spencer?
Yeah.
He was banned in Canada during the war. Not silly, but it's true.
What effect did the Winnipeg General Strike have on the future municipal and federal, and I guess provincial elections of Manitoba?
Well, it had a long lasting effect right up to the present day. Because I think, in fact, there's no doubt that we can trace the victory in 1969 of the NDP government under Dreyer to the Winnipeg General Strike, because 17 out of 27 of the seats they won were won in Winnipeg. And ever since 1919, Winnipeg has always been half Labour in every election, federal, provincial, and municipal. In fact, two two or three years, I forget which, after the strike, Labor elected the mayor of Winnipeg, Jeff J. Farmer. While these men were in jail, three of them were elected to the provincial legislature.
They weren't NDPers at that time,
were they? Well, there was no NDP.
Yeah, what political party
were they? Well, they were, as I mentioned, all under different parties, but they all ran under the Manitoba Labour Party in the provincial election of 1920. And Woodsworth ran next year for the federal house, and I think Bob Russell did too,
under
the ILP, the Independent Labour Party. And you see, they were thinking of, because these names themselves were suggested, there was the Manitoba Labour Party, the Federated Labour Party, the Dominion Labour Party, and later the Canadian Labour Party. They were all, most of them were British, coming from England. They were all thinking in terms of the Labour Party like they had in England, as a vehicle for political action by the working class. And so they had all these, and they had the same in Ontario, you know, in November 1919, there was a provincial election in Ontario. And it was in the aftermath of the general strike, and no doubt that these results helped. The 11 Labour were elected in the provincial elections in Ontario in 1919, and joined up with the farmers to form a first and only farmer labor government in Canadian history. So, in 1921, Whitworth was elected from Winnipeg Centre, and in 1925, he was joined by A.A. Heaps, who had also had been elected as a strike leader, and he was elected from the Independent Labour Party in 1925, so then they had two out of four. From that moment on, two out of four federal seats in Winnipeg have always been Labour. And an equal number of provincial seats until 69, when they got an absolute majority of seats in Winnipeg. And then there was also one part of the General Strike Forces went over to the communist side after the war, after the strike, when they formed the Communist Party. And they, too, in a certain sense, benefited because Winnipeg, for them, has been the strongest electoral. They have had people in city council for years, and my father was one of them. He was joined the Communist Party as one of the founding members in 1921. He was in the general strike, and he sat in the city council for 27 years. From Federation that united the AFL unions in Canada. You have to be an AFL union to belong to the Trade and Labour Congress. The leadership were opposed to the strike. They did everything they possibly could to sabotage it. And mainly because lurking in the background was the possibility of the launching of a new Western Union movement called the OBU, the One Big Union, which was going to organize along industrial lines and was going to be Canadian-run union. And Tom Moore and Patty Draper and Samuel Domford and Gideon Robertson felt that a victory for the Winnipeg General Strike would be a victory for industrial unionism, Canadian unionism, and would prejudice their own position. And generally, they were not militant men. They were men who liked to sit down and have a beer and a cigar with Arthur Meehan and work things out in that way. They were absolutely opposed to strikes. But an interesting thing happened to show how there was quite a division as far as the rank and file of the union movement was. After the first preliminary hearing, the men were locked up. The arrested men were locked up in Headingley Jail without bail. And the Winnipeg Defense Committee demanded that bail be granted, and the government refused. So therefore, they issued an ultimatum that there would be a nationwide general strike on September the 21st if bail was not granted. Tom Moore issued a statement repudiating that and saying he was not in support of that. But in the meantime, from all over the country, the trade union movement was responding and saying that they will go on strike. They will join that strike. In Toronto, in Montreal, in Halifax, in Cape Breton, in Vancouver, in Lethbridge, they all signified that they were going to go out. And so on September the 11th, 10 days before the end of the ultimatum, the men were released on bail. And during that year, there was arrested strike leaders who were out on bail or who had already had their trial were going across the country raising money and raising support, and they got a lot of it. For instance, when they went to Sydney, two members went to Sydney, Nova Scotia. The mayor and city council declared Winnipeg General Strike Day in Sydney, and they were welcomed. They had a meeting of thousands of coal miners and steel workers and so on. There was great support from the lower echelons of labor, but from the top Trades and Labor Congress executive or leadership, Tom Moore in particular, were opposed to it.
But it didn't have any effect in uniting the labor movement, really, because of the top echelons.
Well, what was, I don't know what you mean by uniting. You see, there was the one main union center of the Trade and Labor Congress. The problem was, as they saw it at the time, to expand the trade union movement. The only way the trade union movement could be expanded is through the organization along industrial lines, because these were the workers who were out of the union. But this was smashed, you see, in the smashing of the strike. The idea of industrial unionism had to wait another 20 years. So in that sense, it didn't. It was a momentary setback, actually.
There were, Western Federation of Miners and railway workers in the West, they didn't belong to the TLC, did they? They were?
Well, what happened, I don't know about the Western Federation of Miners, but the United Mine Workers of District 18, which is Alberta and certain parts of British Columbia, went on strike in December 1919. And they joined the OBU. In other words, they were breaking away from the UMW International. So Gideon Robertson, who was Minister of Labor in the government, went to the mine owners with officials from the United States, from the UMW, from John L. Lewis, and signed an agreement with the mine owners giving substantial wage increases to members of the UMW. In other words, in order to qualify for these increases, you have to resign from the OBU and rejoin the International Union. So here you had the government, the mine owners, conspiring with the International Union to replace the International Union over against the wishes of the workers who had already left the International Union. And of course, the workers, being workers, had no other course. They had to rejoin the UMW in order to get the wage increase. And that's how they smashed the OBU, actually. So that in the immediate aftermath, you could say, well, there was negatives and pluses in the immediate aftermath. The defeat was a defeat. economically, the workers didn't win their demands for a collective bargaining. The OBU didn't get off the ground. But in other ways, it was a victory politically because the workers began to organize politically as a result of the experience of the strike. And certainly in the federal elections that came after the strike in 1921, party that Meehan headed, he was now prime minister, was utterly defeated. Every one of his seats in the West, including his own, was lost. He went down from about 150 seats to 50. And that was the way in which people had of rendering their verdict upon his conduct. And in that sense, the strike was a success. Now, what happened there is quite interesting, too. Immediately after the end of the strike in Winnipeg, at the time of the strike, the Winnipeg City Council was divided 7 anti-labor or non-labor and 5 labor, and the mayor, who was a non-labor. So it was 8-5. Immediately after the general strike, Mayor Gray and his supporters in the city council pushed through a bill changing the method of election to what they called proportional representation, transferable vote, in order to prevent what they saw was coming. In other words, the whole principle of the transferable vote is that a liberal or a conservative will vote 1 for a liberal and 2 for a conservative, and none for labor, but labor will only vote 1 for labor. So in other words, the proponents of labor will have effectively 2 votes for everyone that's voted against them. This worked in a certain way, but in the elections of November 1919, the Winnipeg City Council, they increased their representation to 7. But with 7-7 and the Mayor Gray. But it was only that because of this business of the transfer of a vote. If it hadn't been for the transfer of a vote, they would have had a clear majority. Labor would have had a clear majority and probably elect the mayor. The other thing that they had in Winnipeg, which worked against in the municipal elections, is property votes. You could vote in all 3 wards if you had property. And of course, the working class didn't have property in 1 ward, let alone in 3. And they used this method also in the provincial elections the following year in the city of Winnipeg. They declared the city of Winnipeg 1 constituency to elect 10 members at large from that 1 constituency by the transferable vote. So Brother Pritchard was almost elected. He had not first choice votes to be elected, but when they started transferring the votes of his opponents, they overtook him. So where the law suited them, they used it. Where they needed laws that weren't in existence, they created them. When they did everything at that time to defeat labor. And of course, theoretically, you can only defeat labor for so long because the labor, society can't function without labor, as they found out in Winnipeg.
Today in Winnipeg, there's no evidence of the strike. There's no monuments in the museum. Nothing that students in Winnipeg really can see related to the strike.
Well, no, that's not entirely true. There's no monument. That's true. There's no monument. In fact, in 1969. 50th anniversary of the strike, the United Steelworkers proposed to put a plaque up on the City Hall in honor of the strike, and that started the strike all over again. It was a big fight in the Winnipeg City Council, and they didn't agree to it. But at the University of Manitoba, they are collecting an awful lot of material on the Winnipeg strike, and a lot of material is already starting to come out. A whole number of professors in Winnipeg, in the University of Manitoba, are working on it. And then there are lots of archives now in Ottawa on the site, and even
just on the question of literature, it's kind of interesting. I have a poem. One of the Marxist pamphlets published by the Vancouver Trade and Labor Council in 1918, this figure one thought is kind of wonderful to be done, or something like that. It's something like that. It's the introduction by Alan Louis Strong. This is a mass-produced Marxist literature in 4 to 5 minutes. I can't see the Vancouver Labor Council doing that today. There must have been a massive amount of material like this spread through the country itself.
This was when?
1918. 2 years prior to the Communist Party being formed.
Three.
And it was put out by the Vancouver Labor Council out of possession. That was for 5 minutes.
I didn't know that. I didn't think that any of Lenin's works were published until about the latter part of 1919.
It might have been 1919.
Yeah.
Yeah, 1919.
Yeah, I think it's left wing communism, isn't it?
No. Apparently, there were 4 such pamphlets published by the Trade and Labor Council.
They said that the strike was a Bolshevik plot and they were going to sign from the Soviet government. To what extent, did the Russian Revolution influence the strike itself? It was only a few years later. To what extent, could you say that there was a direct influence from the strike?
So there was a direct and an indirect. Maybe I'll start with the indirect first. Indirect may not be the right word, but the conditions that gave rise to the Russian Revolution were primarily a whole worldwide disillusionment as a result of World War I, particularly on the part of the workers and poor people who suffered. The whole establishment, had been such a bloody struggle, a bloodbath, and so corrupt and horrible. The thing was that the workers in all countries began to look very skeptically at their rulers, at the people that they had looked up to, and in that sense, the Winnipeg General Strike and the conditions in Canada of ferment and discontent were the same. The direct impact was that the Russian Revolution was regarded in all of these countries as a break with the old system. And there was an enormous amount of sympathy for the Russian Revolution throughout the world on the part of the people. And I'm quite sure this is right, that Lenin's works were not available, but they just felt instinctively that this was a workers' government and it should be supported. To add to that, of course, was the fact that 14 nations, including Canada, sent expeditionary force to Russia to overthrow the Bolshevik government. And this was very widely opposed in Canada and was throughout the world. They had been through 4 years of war. They had looked upon the new Russian government as a workers' government, and here their government was sending troops to smash it. So this had a direct effect. This increased the bitterness which the workers of Canada felt to the way they had suffered during the war. And it was just one more indication that the government of Ottawa was an anti-labor, anti-working class government. So in that sense, so they interpreted it, you see, any support for the Russian Revolution, you must be a Bolshevik. And in fact, this type of thing went on for years and years afterwards. I have a book at home written by a well-known professor at the time who says that the Ontario Hydro was an emanation of Lenin and the Third International. And he quotes from the communist, from the program of the Third International. And in that way, they could have also said that Meehan was a communist because he nationalized the Canadian National Railway. I don't know how many of you have seen this film, Sacco and Manzetti. Well, you see some of this Red Scare that was going on in the United States at the exact same time.
What time was the
same time. 1919. Yeah. The one? 1920?
So the strike was really part of the general movement that was in it. How far south is Baltimore and then came to southern states and right across the end.
Well, yes, and then in Los Angeles, or was it San Francisco? Where did Mooney come from? Mooney.
San Francisco.
Leader of the Streetcar Railwaymen's Union in San Francisco was arrested and charged with plotting to blow up a parade of soldiers,
mm-hmm.
and was sentenced to the electric chair. And then a worldwide movement of protest got it commuted to life imprisonment, but he was framed. But it was all part of this hysteria. That was in 1937.
And Woodrow Wilson wouldn't pardon him when I was dead. But who was the president at the time? Mooney was pardoned by the governor of California, and who was elected on that plank. He would let Mooney out. I met Tom Mooney when he came out in Los Angeles. Very happy to meet me, and I never met him. And he was sympathetic to me because I'd been in jail for 12 months. I said, "Hey, fella, you were there for 20 years. He said, "Yes." Well, I said, "What did you do all that time?" He said, "I kept reading your speech." I guess it made a time fly. So I'd like to bring this up to you. And it's not that I don't want to boast. That's the worst thing that anyone can do, and especially when you're getting very old, because you might be caught short. And I don't want you to judge on appearances. But how do I sound? Did you hear anything that was said at the meeting today or the other days? Now, I may look suspicious. I may look like a conspirator. But do I sound like one? At this point, long before the Winnipeg strike, and I addressed meetings in this town as a young fellow, socialist meetings, and I remember on one occasion stating definitely when a point came up, briefly, Canada is the economic backyard of the United States. That was then. You know the truth of it now. I only needed to touch one point, and that was the Guggenheims on gold and the hard rock mining in British Columbia. It was although politically tied to the British crown, it was economically governed by the United States economic interests, as it is today very largely. I also said at that time that only fools try to make revolutions. Wise men conform to them, because these are historic events that are beyond either the planning or the control of men. They are the bursting point of a long line of evolution, and there's an upsurge. If you're wise, you'll conform to that and try to understand. Don't try to make one. Well, those two things were stated along with other things, long before the Winnipeg strike. Anita, recognizing that the United States is the economic sovereign of Canada, and I was a Canadian then, British law, and recognizing the economic and military power of the United States and the holy title which Canada is, surely the kind of a fool that would conspire to overthrow the Canadian government in the face of the military might of the United States. I put that to you. Do you think I would do it now? Or do you think I would try to do it then, knowing what I knew? But you see, there are types of mind, and normally brought it out, into which an idea cannot penetrate. And very often this type of mind finds itself elected to office. And you'll find in the United States of America today, I don't know about Canada because I'm not in trouble with this country as a foreigner. But in the United States, you have men in office into whose head no idea later than 1862 was ever entered. And they govern the country. And they prove it, you know, in this. But the vice president called it various entries into the Watergate Hotel as capers. These are overzealous men doing the right thing in the wrong way, and he said that we ought to dismiss these capers. Well, if anybody burglarizes a bank, you call it a caper. Mm-hmm. Only a vice president of the United States, or maybe the president, could be so foolish as to call this operation a caper. This is something the child is, you know. Standing on the street.
Nixon yesterday said that they were little, unimportant things. Nixon said yesterday.
These men were Nixon's men. They were stamped in his image. And they partook of his philosophy. And what they call the underlings were brought into their positions by Nixon's pick men. All of them. And they turn out to be members of the CIA, members of the FBI, where they got their training, retired officers in military service, and they go burglarizing. Eddie and Hunt, McCall, they're all in the FBI and the CIA. Now, the CIA's job has nothing to do with the country, so we're told. Its job is to go into Honduras and set up a counter-insurrection so we can overthrow the government. Democratically elected of Guatemala, The CIA's job is to go into Rome and interfere in the Italian election. It's to go into everybody else's backyard and tell them what to do. Because we are the economic. I would have come to it in that speech that might have lasted until now. Where an authority says we have the muscle, we are in the driver's seat, and we want to stay there. And they're going to charge upon what they must do. That's the position they take there. I don't think anyone would think that would be so silly.
I've got that passage that you're talking about. This is from Fitch's address in 1920. I know in the law we have nothing to do with the United States, but I know that you cannot touch an industry in Canada of any account without touching the United States capital.
Is that what I see? I remember that.
Did you have an extensive note for 2 days in the office of the call on Africa?
Did you have the extensive notes for your speech in the trial? Or did you?
No, I just have notes on the point, and I had the exhibits I wanted to use, and I placed them in order, the number given in by the class, you know, exhibit number so. And I knew in my mind where I just stopped. Trouble is, I often didn't know where to stop. But I had to stop at Charlie Clark because that was the end of the session. I was tired on the second day. So I had those notes and I knew what I wanted to argue about it, the letters, the documents, and so on. I don't know. And it might have been easy, but I was constantly interrupted by the Crown Council and by the judge. When to the jury. That was when they did it. A lot of them. They're funny now. But you know, the funny thing is that the man that made the money in the trial, this man that Norman's talking about, A.J. Andrews, who was the one voice in the Citizens Committee, he was the Citizens Committee. It was a committee of 1,000, it was a committee of one man, like the American government, one man. But this chap came to me after I had been found guilty, and he said, I'm going to do my best, he said, to get you out. Well, I said, you did your best to get me in. I said, I don't know who she is. What time she is. He said, I want you to come and see me when you come out. But I want to take you into my office and train you in the law. He made that offer. I didn't go to see him. I didn't see him until 1932 when I attended the Minden Municipal Convention in Winnipeg. Then he wanted to tell me what was the matter with the world. He wanted to ask my opinion. Well, he said, unemployment, business is bad, everything's bad, it's bad, everything's bad, it's terrible. What are we going to do about it? Here's the man that... Well, I looked him in the eye and I said, I came here just for curiosity, to see what you look like. And Russell said, would I like to come to see you? And I said, yes. So I came. I wanted to say hello. He said, yes. Now I said, sir, if you think that now, at this time, I'm going to give you my opinion of what should be done throughout the world under the present conditions, to the man who got me sent to jail for doing that very thing some years ago, you're mistaken. I said, God damn it, you've not changed a bit. Now that was A.G. Andrews. And that's the humorous side of it. And if you don't see that, you'll die. You know? That's all those stupid and all of this morning. For goodness sake, maintain your sense of humor while you go with this thing of your study. Because the man who has no sense of humor very likely will turn out to be a man that has no other kind of sense either. You know, put that in the box. I wish I was in your place, you know, so I could go to school and learn something.
You still sound like a conspirator.
In which way? Because I'm conspiring to get the young to read, and to not only read, but to think about what they read, and to listen, but to analyze what it is they are listening to. Sure. Conspirator. Conspire. What is it? In the Latin. Breathe. To breathe together. And that's what he said he was guilty of. We fellows have breathed together. When we were sent out to the jail farm, we had a new guard come down from Scotland. He was the brother of the chief. And we went out one day and we were working, as usual, digging, putting up fence posts in the fence. And it was big guns, I think. They said, hey, today is the day that Winnipeg's going on strike again. A big protest, remember that? Because we were in jail. He said, they're on strike in Winnipeg, are we working? And he dropped his tools, so we dropped his tools, And this young chief said, that's all right. So we sit around, and we weren't supposed to have any tobacco, but I dug out of a pipe, and the guard gave me some tobacco. So we smoked as we sat on the place. And immediately there comes a discussion between Ivans, the idealist, and old dog Armstrong, the comic materialist. And John Queen gets into the saga, and I'm into it. So, and this Scotch guy said, hey, and we looked up to him. What do you say you fellows are in here for? And Queen says, for seditious conspiracy. And the guy says, my God, you can't agree on anything. Collins was an idealist and came out of the Methodist Church and carried his idealism to the point of where he wanted to do something for humanity. But I know how he should talk of history or historic development or of economics. And then there's Bray, who just carried along with us. Green then was in the Social Democratic Party, so he differed with us slightly. Yes, even with arguing philosophical matters why we went on strike for no day on our own behalf. This was the question. You can't agree on anything. He couldn't imagine how we got it convinced of to conspire together. That is the result productivity of labor itself, which is given even to the masters, things that they never had before, and is given to the workers what is known as a copy. I never heard of it until I saw them sitting out here taking copies and then took a struggle. I worked in Baker not too long ago in LA where we were working out here. We got a break after 8 hours to go and eat. But there were no coffee breaks as such. There's a standard of living. The average worker today is higher than the standard of living of the gallant knight of the Middle Ages, who with all his contraption very often slept on the straw pallet. Standard of living is a general rise in the standard of living of the whole of society, because now labor can produce much more with much less effort. That's what an agent is doing. And we come to the day when he says to push the button or pull off the button. The machine is doing it anyhow. The railroad yard that's going off at Colton on the SP is a huge thing. The whole thing will be automation run by a man that's out in power. Switching, coupling, all the rest of the work might have to be done electronically. Produced primarily for human use. They have a use, but they are produced by labor.